in keeping with a commitment that we made to have an overview of a book in the Bible and then follow the following Sunday with a lesson from a text in the book, tonight we'll have an overview of the book of Numbers in the Old Testament, and I've called that Census Report in the Wilderness because that's where the term numbers comes from. It's a numbering of the people. In our English Bibles, it refers to two numberings or two censuses taken of men of fighting age among the Israelites. One in chapter 1 was taken as the people left Mount Sinai to go to the Promised Land, and the other, chapter 26, was taken 38 years later when the next generation prepared to go into the land of Canaan. This is where the title of the book comes from for English readers. The background of this book, Moses, of course, is the author of this book, as indicated by the text in a couple of different places. It was written at the conclusion of the wilderness wanderings. And having received instructions on how to approach God, the people were now ready to cross over and go into the land that God had promised them. So they left Sinai and they headed for Canaan, a relatively short march. But when they reached the southern border of the Promised Land, the land that God described to them as a land flowing with milk and honey, if you remember, spies were sent to survey the land. The people believed the 10 spies who brought back a very discouraging report in consideration of their human ability to overcome the obstacles that presented themselves in this land. And for their sin of unbelief, the people were punished in that they wandered in the wilderness until most of the original generation was dead. The time covered is about 38 years in time, detailed in the book. Key events in this book of 36 chapters, 1,288 verses, and approximately 33,000 words. Looking at the outline, key events are outlined in the book, just to think about how we would go about outlining this book. We could break it down into three major sections. The first one would be getting ready to leave Mount Sinai to go into the Promised Land was the goal there. The first census was made in chapter 1. Some details about organizing the camp for traveling in the next couple of chapters. Laws on purity and the Nazarite vow are covered in chapter 5 and 6. Sacrifices made by each tribe in chapter 7. Laws about Levites are given in chapter 8. The Passover is kept and a cloud is guiding them as they travel in chapter 9. And the signal trumpet is talked about in the beginning verses of chapter 10. Then as we look further into the second major division of the book, the 40-day journey that really... It should have taken 40 days or, you know, moving at a very slow pace, but was not the case. It actually took 40 years, you remember from the text. We see the first trip to the Promised Land where they start out to the land, actually, in chapter 10. And on the way, as they're traveling, we begin to hear this murmuring and this complaining about things in chapter 11 and 12. And in those couple of chapters, you might remember the 70 elders were appointed. You might remember the quails that God sent to feed them. You might remember the jealousy of Miriam and Aaron. And then when they get to the southern edge of the Promised Land, you remember the 12 spies were sent out, and 10 spies gave an unfavorable report of the prospects of overtaking this land. And so they were doomed to wander in the land for 40 years in chapter 14. Very disheartening to read about that, but somewhat sympathetic with the human condition of disobedience to the things of God in that chapter. We see the wandering given. Some details we don't have about that. We have some questions about that sometimes, but God saw fit not to include every detail, as is true in many other situations. But He offers laws about certain offerings, and a man is stoned in chapter 15. The rebellion of Korah and his followers is detailed very carefully as an example for everyone who would come after that about the sin of rebellion in chapter 16 and 17. Some laws about offerings are given in chapter 18, water of purification in chapter 19, and then the last trip to the promised land, starting from Kadesh, where we read about Moses' sin in chapter 20 and the death of Aaron also in that chapter. And on the way, there's murmuring going on again in chapter 21, and we read about the brazen serpent in that section of the book. If you remember, the arrival on the eastern side of the promised land, about chapter 22. And then the third division is given for us in the book, where they're getting ready to enter the land of Canaan. And we see a strange story about Balak and Balaam in chapter 22 through chapter 25. It seems somewhat strange for us to read a story like that. Very curious. The Bible reader that such a story as that would be included there. The second census is taken in chapter 26, a problem of inheritance, and Joshua is chosen in chapter 27. Then there's some more laws about offerings given and certain days and certain vows in chapter 28 through 30. The battle against the Midianites happens in chapter 31. Two and a half tribes decide to stay on the east side of the Jordan River in chapter 32. A summary is given of the wilderness wanderings in chapter 33, and instructions about inheritances after they enter the land of Canaan in chapters 34 through 36. And you might remember that I believe it's chapter 35 that talks about the cities of refuge that you remember studying about in your studies of the Old Testament previous to this, or in your personal Bible reading at home. So that's kind of an outline of the book. There are some key words in the book that really signal, if you wanted to just grab some words out of the book that indicate what this book is about, wanderings would be a word that you would grab out of the bag of words that describe the book, or sojourning. Two words that really kind of summarize the book, and the book takes its name from that, numbering, you know, having a census of the people, and murmuring. Murmuring is quite prevalent in the book, and we'll talk some more about that a little bit later. If you think maybe about some key verses in the book that kind of signal the flavor of the book, you know, what is it about? Well, read these few verses and you'll get a flavor of what Numbers is about. Chapter 14 would be one of those places where some key verses would be found. Verses 6 through 9, for example, Joshua the son of Nun and Caleb the son of Jephunneh, of those who had spied out the land, tore their clothes, and they spoke to all the congregation of the sons of Israel, saying, "The land which we passed through to spy out is an exceeding good land." You know, just like God told them that it was. "If the Lord is pleased with us, then He will bring us into this land and give it to us, a land which flows with milk and honey. Only do not rebel against the Lord, and do not fear the people of the land, for they will be our prey. Their protection has been removed from them, and the Lord is with us. Do not fear them." You know, that's really a key passage in the book, isn't it? Chapter 14 also, 22 and 23 would be key, I think, because it says, "Surely all the men who have seen my glory and my signs which I performed in Egypt and in the wilderness, yet have put me to the test these 10 times and have not listened to my voice. shall by no means see the land which I swore to their fathers, nor shall any of those who spurned me see it." You know, that those couple of verses certainly indicate the flavor of the book, don't they? Chapter 20 and verse 12, "But the Lord said to Moses and Aaron, because you have not believed me to treat me as holy in the sight of the sons of Israel, therefore you shall not bring this assembly into the land which I have given them." Chapter 22 and verse 18, "Balaam replied to the servants of Balak, though Balak were to give me his house full of silver and gold, I could not do anything, either small or great, contrary to the command of the Lord my God." That would strike a keynote with you about some of the contents that are in the book. One more, chapter 32 and verse 23, "But if you will not do so, behold, you have sinned against the Lord, and be sure your sin will find you out." We've probably heard that quoted in some lessons or some sermons or something. In our Bible classes for our young people, "Be sure your sin will find you out." It comes from the book of Numbers. It's in chapter 32 and verse 23. Some key phrases in the book, probably what jumps out at me is what God said in the book, "because you have not believed me." You know, that's a big attention getter for a student of the Bible, isn't it? "Whoever was able to go out to war" is a phrase that's used over a dozen times in the first chapter alone. When all who could fight were mustered for the battles that were ahead in taking over the promised land. A key chapter, probably thinking about a chapter that's key to the whole book, maybe it's chapter 14. We did look at some verses from that chapter already when we thought about key verses there. The critical turning point in Israel's journey from bondage to the promised land is seen in Numbers 14. When the people, through fear and unbelief, refused to go in and conquer the land like God had commanded them to do. Therefore, God condemned all from 20 years old and upward who have grumbled against me, in verse 29 of chapter 14, to perish in the wilderness, except for Joshua and Caleb, those who gave a favorable report of the land and tore their clothes and said, "The Lord's given us the land. The Lord will make these people pray for us. We can take it." Then in verses 31 through 35, in this chapter, really give a key to the book, I think. Your children, however, whom you said would become a prey, I will bring them in and they will know the land which you have rejected. But as for you, your corpses will fall in the wilderness. You know, not really a pleasant type of expression to say to someone, is it? Your sons shall be shepherds for 40 years in the wilderness, and they will suffer for your unfaithfulness. Until your corpses lie in the wilderness, according to the number of days which you spied out the land, 40 days, for every day you shall bear your guilt a year, even 40 years, and you will know my opposition. I, the Lord, have spoken. Surely this I will do to all this evil congregation who are gathered together against me. In this wilderness they shall be destroyed, and there they will die. Harsh words, don't you think? From chapter 14. So that presents itself, you know, kind of vividly as a key chapter in the book. Well, why was this book written? Or what are some of the purposes involved in it? Or some of the main themes or main ideas that we can consider briefly in a lesson of this type? The central thought seems to be that there is the concept of obedience to God, and in that obedience to God, you see an orderly service going on in serving the God of heaven. You don't see any any disorganization or things that seem like they were thrown together. But to the contrary, you see detailed instructions about things, the tabernacle, the priests, what they were to do, how to offer a sin offering and things like that. You see those type of details played out. God clearly shows the necessity of obedience and the results of disobedience in the book. That's really clear. God gave them a law. He gave them the tabernacle. He gave them the priesthood. And His abiding presence in order to bring them into a land that He had promised them. And this was no destitute land. This was a land that was rich in prosperity. This was a land that was just overflowing with God's beautiful and wonderful bounty to be able to sustain people, keep them alive, make their hearts very happy for having an abundance of things that they could share with other people, and they could offer great sacrifices to God. That was the nature of the land that He promised them. And if they obeyed His commandments, all would be well with them, and they would live for a long time in the land. Unbelief bars entrance into an abundant life, and also a heavenly hope, according to the book of Hebrews in chapter 3. Unbelief has been the besetting sin of God's people in every generation, according to the Hebrew writer in the New Testament, chapter 12, and verse 1. Through God's dealings with them in the wilderness, the Israelites learned to serve God in a way that was respectful of God, reverent toward God, and explicit obedience to His commandments. These lessons were really given to prove the younger generation, as is stated in Deuteronomy 8 and verse 2, to humble you, testing you to know what was in your heart, whether you would keep His commandments or not. You know, God needs to know that about His followers that verbally claim to be following Him, doesn't He? He needs to know, really, what is in your heart, and what's in your heart will come out by what you do. So this was a test. This was a proving. And I think that's a significant thing about the book, theme-wise. Something else that we might think about is that the tabernacle really was a type to teach people something about service and order when it comes to serving and worshiping God. Just as the tabernacle was at the center of the camp, so service to God was to be at the center of each person's life. The book shows God's love of order and also His demand for order. Christians are admonished in the pages of the New Testament in 1 Corinthians chapter 14 and verse 40, but all things must be done properly and in an orderly manner. Or decently and in order, if you use the King James Version. Each tribe and family had its allotted position in reference to the tabernacle. Each had his assigned work to do in the camp, whether they were stationary or on the move, on the march. And God's people are always blessed by Him to serve other people. That's always been important with God. The New Testament provides the divine order for salvation from sin, acceptable worship to God, organization of God's people on the earth as they come together and do together things that God has shown in His Word are things that please Him and ways that He blesses His people in such. Everything, Peter said, everything pertaining to life and godliness, God has given us. In 2 Peter 1 and verse 3. God demands that we make all things according to the pattern that He has described for us in the New Testament Scriptures. It was very important that Moses, in building the tabernacle, followed those instructions to the letter. See that you do all things according to the pattern. Hebrews 8 and verse 5. And what an important principle that is to please God. God is one who loves order. and He has revealed things about orderliness to His children, and His children glorify Him by following His order, don't they? Faithful obedience, we've talked some about that already. When Moses and Aaron disobeyed God in smiting the rock, God said, "Because you have not believed me to treat me as holy in the sight of the sons of Israel, therefore you shall not bring this assembly into the land which I have given them," in chapter 20 and verse 12. Faith in God and obedience to God are just inseparable. You can't break those apart in any way. It just won't work in service to God. Faith without works is dead, even in the New Testament. James taught that in James 2 in verse 26. The tragic results of disobedience is a lesson that we still need even in our society today, don't we? In no other book are the consequences of obedience and disobedience brought into clearer focus or seen in sharper contrast than in the book of Numbers. It's all laid out for us there in what people did in this unique situation of being delivered from Egyptian bondage and moving forward into a great prosperity that they could have possessed. Three such instances of disobedience are clearly outlined for us in the book. We have the rebellion of the people at Kadesh when they refused to enter Canaan in chapters 13 and 14. We have Korah's rebellion when he led 250 princes of the congregation against Moses in chapter 16. And then we have the disobedience of Moses and Aaron at Meribah recorded for us in chapter 20. For their rebellion at Kadesh, the people were barred from Canaan and made to wander in the wilderness for 40 years. And God caused the earth to just open up and swallow Korah and all those who followed him and their households. The record says, and all the men who belonged to Korah with their possessions were swallowed up in the earth, so they and all that belonged to them went down alive into Sheol. Boy, that must have been a frightful thing to see, don't you imagine? And the earth closed over them, and they perished from the midst of the assembly. Boy, you talk about something that would wake you up. That would certainly be it, wouldn't it? For the earth to just swallow up a group of people who'd been rebellious? Oh, that would be frightening to see something like that. It's recorded for us, chapter 16. The disobedience of Moses and Aaron cost them entrance into Canaan. You remember Moses smote the rock in anger. Truly the anger of man does not achieve the righteousness of God. James wrote that in the New Testament. And that could be an example of that very thing, don't you think? Faith and obedience is described in the book. In two of these examples, unbelief and disobedience are interchangeable words to describe exactly what happened. The people were not able to enter in because of unbelief. The Hebrew writer says in the New Testament, in Hebrews 3 and verse 19, and in chapter 4 of Hebrews in verse 11, in reference to the same thing, it's called an example of disobedience. So you have unbelief and disobedience. Those two terms used interchangeably there to describe what the reverse of what should have been the right relationship with God, but it wasn't. Moses disobeyed God, and God said, "You have not believed me," in Numbers 20 and verse 12. There's no difference between belief and obedience, or faith and works in the sight of God. You either have both, or you're missing something valuable and precious. Saving faith is always, always an obedient faith in God's book. We are warned carefully in the book of Hebrews in the New Testament, warned to beware of unbelief. Beware of unbelief. and also of faith without works in James 2:26. You see that a man is not justified, you see that a man is justified by works and not by faith alone. James 2:24. I'll get that out in a minute. You see, the two just go together. And Numbers shows indeed that's the case. And others writing later, Book of Hebrews, for example, in reference to what happened in the book of Moses, uses those two terms interchangeably. And that's a point to keep in mind. Very, very important. Maybe some other important things to notice about the book. The census, obviously, is an important thing. If you're going to name a book after numbering some people, there's something important about a census. In chapter 1, we see some 600,000 people, men from 20 years old and upward, who were able to go forth to war. That was the number of men, 603,550 in chapter 1. And a number very close to that at Moab, 601,730 in chapter 26, not including the Levites. A conservative estimate of women and children gives a population of about 2 million people. That's a conservative estimate. So if you can imagine 2 million people wandering around in a wilderness area, and think about the mechanics of camping and animal sacrifices to God and worship at the tabernacle. And you know, if you could just mull that over in your mind and think about how incredible that really must have been to be a part of that group. It's sad that most of that number perished, and many failed to enter the promised land because of unbelief. Many thousands of them were destroyed because of immorality, because of lust, because of murmuring, and because of idolatry. Those things are listed in great detail, and those details are also mentioned in the New Testament in 1 Corinthians chapter 10. There are about a dozen verses there that talk about the example of these people in the wilderness there. It's an eye-opening 12 verses of Scripture in the New Testament in 1 Corinthians 10. The old nation died except Joshua and Caleb. A new nation was trained in obedience to the things of God in preparation for entering the land of Canaan. Important things to notice. We talked about the murmuring or complaining that people did. Those are cataloged very carefully and very specifically for us in the book. There is murmuring about the way that God led them in chapter 11. Concerning the food that He fed them also in chapter 11. Concerning the land and the giants in it in chapter 13 and chapter 14. Complaining about the leaders that God appointed over them in chapter 16 and 17. Oh, wow, don't we need that lesson today. Complaining about God's judgments. You know, people need that lesson today too. People don't like the way that God feels about something that they want to do if God says it's not right. Concerning their thirst in the desert in chapter 20. And the second time concerning God's provision for them and manna for them in chapter 21. You know, all of these murmurings, on the surface you think it's all against Moses. But that's not really the heart of the issue. The heart of the issue is this murmuring and complaining was ultimately against God. That's just the brass tacks of the situation. They showed their unbelief. They showed their ingratitude. They were a source of grief, certainly to Moses, but they were a source of grief to God as well. An important thing, the crisis at Kadesh. You remember the story of the spies. 12 were sent. They came back. 10 were fearful. You know, we're like grasshoppers in their sight. There are giants in the land. We won't be able to do anything with these people. Their fortifications are so strong. You know, just a faithless consideration of their human ability to do something, and a forgetting altogether that the God of the universe was on their side, and they could not be defeated if God was on their side. Joshua and Caleb were the only ones who remembered that. The punishment was very severe, I think. You can't mention important things in the book, I think. This is strictly my personal thing. Without a reference to the beautiful benediction in chapter 6, verses 24, 25, and 26. Some of the most beautiful words that you will ever read in God's book, I think. Then the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, "Speak to Aaron and to his sons, saying, Thus you shall bless the sons of Israel. You shall say to them," and hear the words of that beautiful benediction, "The Lord bless you and keep you. The Lord make his face to shine on you and be gracious to you. The Lord lift up his countenance upon you and give you peace. So they shall invoke my name on the sons of Israel, and then will I bless them." If you can't read that and come away thinking those are some of the most beautiful words that you've ever read, please see me after worship tonight. We need to talk. Aren't those incredibly beautiful, blessing words? Christ in the book of Numbers. Do you see anything in the book of Numbers that reminds you about Jesus Christ? There's a bunch of stuff. Messianic types are all in this book. The smitten rock, for example. You know, there's a reference to that in the pages of the New Testament in 1 Corinthians 10. And what does the record say about it there? It plainly describes that that was a type of Christ. It was a messianic reference. The brazen serpent is mentioned in the New Testament in John's Gospel, chapter 3. In consideration of how Christ would be lifted up from the earth, and he was on that cross of wood, wasn't he? The cities of refuge in chapter 35 of Numbers are mentioned in the New Testament in Hebrews chapter 6. Animal sacrifices outside the city. Christ was crucified outside the city. There's some messianic reference there, some type that brings to mind something about Jesus Christ there. Remember that everything in the Old Testament is either to bring men to Christ or prepare their minds for Him. Well, let's think very quickly about some lessons that we can learn from the book of Numbers. We can't, you know, preach a lot of lessons about that tonight because of our time limitations, but if you think about just some of the important lessons that just jump out at you. Servants of God can fall. You know, that's a big, powerful lesson, and we see that in the book. 1 Corinthians chapter 10 in the New Testament, several verses there, Paul makes this very powerful argument. You've got to be careful because you can fall just like these people fell. And the examples are all laid out so that we can read them and we can understand what they did wrong, what they were thinking that led them down the wrong path. Let him who thinks he stands take heed lest he fall. Those are the words of Paul in the New Testament using this example. Heed God's warnings. Listen to His warnings. Act on His warnings. Don't do what He says not to do. Do what He says to do. That's a powerful lesson that comes through loud and clear in the pages of the book of Numbers. The writer of Hebrews uses the example of the Israelites to warn Christians, even today in Hebrews chapter 3 through chapter 4. He says they fell because of disobedience, which is a symptom of their unbelief. Beware of unbelief in Hebrews 3 and verse 12. We have to learn lessons through Israel's experience and God's dealings with them. We have to learn those lessons so that we can benefit from overcoming mistakes that we could make had we not had those examples. Now these things happened to them as an example. They were written for our instruction, upon whom the ends of the ages have come, Paul said in 1 Corinthians 10, verse 11. And the most obvious expression of the Israelites' unbelief was their complaining. Another thing we see in the book is beware of the desire for riches. We see that in the case of the false prophet Balaam, chapter 22 through 24. First refusing the offer of Balak, king of Moab, if he would curse Israel. He later accepted the gold and the silver, only to find that blessing came forth from his mouth instead of a curse of God's people. However, he did cause Israel to sin. Another lesson I think is important before we close is beware of the grasshopper complex. And you see that in the report that the 10 spies come back and they just, we can't do this. They're looking at it through human reasoning and consideration of their own human ability, as we mentioned before. You know, we can have that grasshopper complex today, can't we? Without due consideration of God, our protector, the one who blesses us, the one who watches over us, the one who cares for us every day of our lives, we can kind of get to thinking that we're all alone here and we need to make our own decisions. And, you know, we can shy away from what great things God expects us to do because we have this little grasshopper complex. I'm not talented enough to do that. I'm not courageous enough to do that. I'm not smart enough to do that. But we sometimes sell ourselves short, and that's not a good thing. That's the grasshopper complex. Be careful about that. Beware of that. The story of Israel in the wilderness, as related in Numbers, can be written, I think, in three words: discontent, disaster, and discipline. Discontent, the Israelite march from Sinai to the brink of the promised land, you know, only to have their discontent flow out of their mouths in terms of murmuring and complaining and ultimately resulting in rebellion. Disaster, because of their rebellion against God, he turned them back, would not allow them to go into the land of Canaan. He delivered them from the slavery that they had to endure in Egypt, and now they were enslaved by their own sins. And the discipline for 38 years, wandering in the wilderness before they were finally allowed to go in and possess the land. Their experiences are our examples, written for our learning, that we may not make the same tragic mistakes that they made in their lives and be denied heaven's blessings ultimately. I hope that this little brief nutshell capsule of a look at Numbers has scratched maybe some things that you've, memory of some things that you've studied in the past. And, you know, it's impossible to go into any great detail about a book of the Bible in a short period of time, but the attempt is just to kind of get a flavor of the book and then maybe follow in a week a lesson from some text in the book and in hopes that will benefit you and keep you on your toes about some things that happen in, you know, some hidden away books in the Old Testament that you may not look at very often. If you're in our assembly today and we can help you spiritually by becoming a Christian, by helping you, praying with you and for you to forsake sin in your life, to rededicate your life to the walk with God, we can certainly do that tonight. If you need that, please come while we encourage you by singing this song.